All right, we're in our. Yeah, you're ready. I just said all right. Yeah, those are coming on in. We have plenty of seats up here. That'll be more than likely for everybody, or more than nice for everybody to come here.
So what happened to the guy with the gun?
Well, that's right. Deep question. Yeah, you know what? I'll start off with that. That's fine. What is crazy was this, as Wade, the guy that was to my right, when he took off running, he hit a second guy was in the middle of the road, and he tried to grab Wade. And Wade shoved him off and kept running. And the guy with the gun and with the guy that was in the middle of the road, they got in a car and went away. And what was crazy, we were talking to the Guatemalans later, they were surprised that he didn't shoot us. But they weren't surprised that he pulled out a gun in broad daylight. They were like, oh, that's Guatemala. And I was like, where was this in the handbook? You know, like, I would have known this. And then they, matter of fact, what was interesting was three separate ones of them looked at us and they said, oh, God must be with you. And we were like, well, yeah, absolutely that's true. Absolutely that's true. Absolutely. You know, and it was one of those things, as the director of prayer for Black Box International, Wade was looking at him and he was like, what's wrong, man? Are you on your knees long enough? Like, what's going on? Like, I don't know. Yeah, exactly. No, so honestly, he just got in his car and left, which is crazy. Maybe so. Maybe so. I don't know what they had in mind, but ultimately got at other plans. And it drove us to Antigua, and we got our connection, and so we looked at it as a celebration. Although my wife, when I told her the night I got home, it wasn't all celebration. It was, you're never leaving again, you know. We've talked that through as well.
Maybe that you had walked into them. A movie scene.
Yeah, I would have enjoyed that. No, it was very real. What I was telling my wife, too, I said, man, I couldn't pick the guy's face out of a lineup if you showed me, but if you put out 10 guns, I could show you which gun it was. No question. That's burnt into my mind. Yeah. Anyway, I want to say thanks for having me here this weekend. It's been fun. I've had a blast, however many sessions we've done. It's been fantastic. So before you get mad at me after the question and answer time, I just want to say thanks. Because who knows where you'll be at the end of this. Might be trying to burn me at the stake. That's okay.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure. My pleasure. Hopefully Revelation's not as scary. That's kind of the goal. And hopefully it's something that we can actually hear John speaking to us in and challenging us to be who he wants us to be. With that, though, I'll just open it up for questions. It can be about anything. Joe was so quick on the draw. I better let Joe start us off, and then we'll make our way around. So.
Okay, in chapter 11 of Revelation, he talks about the two witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And then he talks about how they're killed.
Mm-hmm.
And then he talks about how they're resurrected.
Mm-hmm.
And then he talks about the proclamation or the proclaiming of the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And then in verse 19,
yep.
Then the temple of God was opened in heaven,
mm-hmm.
and the ark of his covenant was seen in his temple.
Yeah.
You know what's coming, don't you?
Maybe not. I don't know.
Probably a three-part question with a follow-up.
Oh my, okay. All right.
What do you suppose was in that ark of the covenant? And if you respond as I think you are, do you think all 10 of them were there?
Mm-hmm.
And if you respond as I think you will, then I ask you, why do you think the preponderance of Christian communities today don't obey all 10 of those?
Yeah, well, let's just start with the third. Ark of the Covenant, I will say this, though, the Ark of the Covenant imagery there is very fascinating. And the reason why I love the Ark of the Covenant imagery there is because in the first century BC, whenever the Roman general Pompey comes into the region of Judea, he comes in, and one of the things he does is he walks right into the temple and goes right into the Holy of Holies. And Josephus tells us he didn't see anything. There's nothing in there. And what's crazy about that means year after year, the high priest was going into the Holy of Holies in order to anoint the seat of God's covenant with the blood and to do the procedures. And year after year, the high priest knew that God's covenant, the Ark of the Covenant, was not there. It wasn't there. That says something pretty profound. That ultimately, God, in what He does through Jesus and what the church fulfills, is what the Ark of the Covenant was pointing to. And that is God's people. God's people. We are the kingdom that the covenant was promised to and was pointing to. Now, to answer your third question, why don't people keep all 10? Man, Acts 15 is the place where this is being wrestled with. What do we do? What when Jesus came, this is something that it's actually really hard for us to swallow. Jesus changes everything. Everything. Major shifts happen because of the cross. Everything's different. Nothing will be the same. How do I prove this? Read Hebrews. Hebrews, what is Hebrews saying? Oh, we don't even need a high priest anymore. He is our high priest. We don't even need sacrifices anymore for atonement. He is our sacrifice. He has actually put the death to that whole system. And Jewish Christians and Jews were wrestling and arguing about what do we keep and what don't we keep. Ultimately, what does Jesus change? So in Acts 15, my word, this is something I was talking to my Acts class about just a couple weeks ago. Whenever the issue of circumcision comes up, it is not about legalism. If you read Genesis 17, when circumcision is laid down, God uses language like, this is my everlasting covenant. And people that don't bear circumcision, in Genesis 17 it says, they will be cut off from my people. And all of a sudden, you have this church that comes in and because of Jesus says, we don't need to do circumcision anymore. And the Jews then were asking legitimate questions. Excuse me? Did you not read the language in Genesis 17 when it was talking about circumcision? You're telling me that Gentiles don't need to be circumcised now? That's a major shift. It is much major than the Sabbath laws. It is much major than anything. When the ark, or whenever the sign of God's covenant, because of what Jesus did, the atoning sacrifices no longer have to be done. Ultimately, what the church says is this. God's shifted. He is moving, and we need to follow Him. That's where somebody will say, sometimes they'll you know, well, I don't want to open up that Pandora's box. It's not necessary. The bottom line is this. Why don't we keep all 10? If anything, Jesus makes all 10 harder to keep. The only one that normally is the one that we have big questions on is the Sabbath. Normally that's the one. And here's my response to that. A couple of things. We are not slaves to the Sabbath, and we never were. Never were. However, if you consistently break Sabbath in your life, it will actually shorten your ministry. One of my deep friends, and I'm privileged even to call him a colleague at this point, Chris DeWell, his dad, incredible man. His name's Don DeWell. The preaching lab at Ozark is named for Don DeWell. He's an amazing, amazing man. His legacy is incredible. And Don DeWell died around 54 because he worked himself into a grave. And Chris said, man, if he would have taken a weekly Sabbath, probably would have had him for about 20 more years. I believe the reason why, if you violate Sabbath on a consistent basis, the reason why that's a problem is because God put that in because He knows you better than you. And He says you need this rhythm of work, consistent work, and of rest. And if you violate the rest, or if you violate the work, you will not fully be being what I've made you to be. So He's not saying if you violate the Sabbath anymore. Jesus said, it's not saying God's going to damn you to hell. That's not what He's saying. What He's saying is this, is I've made you. I know you intimately. Why would you ignore what I've laid down for you? I don't understand. And so I protect my Sabbath. I protect it with everything that's in me. And I do it for my kids, and I do it for the people I minister to. Because I feel like if I am balanced, I'm a better minister if I'm balanced. It's kind of like my students, I tell them, that, you know, they're like, hey, can I come in and talk to you today? No, I'm sorry, today is my blackout day. And my blackout day is I don't deal with any students at all. I don't even answer the phone. I just write lectures. And the reason why is because if I don't do that and they're not being written, then the next day whenever you want to come meet with me, the whole time I'm not even there, I'm thinking of what I need to be doing. So I'm finding ways to find rhythm and balance in my life between both hard work and with rest so that ultimately I can be what God's made me to be. But whenever I don't have that balance, it has physiological implications, emotional as well as spiritual. So while Jesus isn't saying that I'm going to condemn you for the Sabbath law anymore, He is saying, because the Sabbath wasn't Man isn't enslaved to the Sabbath. The Sabbath was given to man as a gift to make sure that our relationship with God was stable when we're in a consistent rhythm that He's laid down and put in each of us.
Well, He gave all the commandments for our benefit anyway.
Absolutely.
Not just the Sabbath, but He gave every one of them because He knew us intimately.
Absolutely, and you know, and that's where man, the way we read Paul sometimes gives the law a bad rap. It really does. The law was an incredible gift of grace. I have this this prayer in my notes. It's from the ancient Near East, the region of Babylon, around the 7th, 8th century BC. And it's this prayer that they found inscribed. And it's this guy, and he's praying. Something tragically has happened in his family, like a child has died or his child is sick. And what he says is, he says, seven times over, I pray to the God of, and he says one God. Seven times over, I pray to the God of, and he says this God. And he goes, and it goes on for about five pages. Seven times over, I pray to this one. He's basically saying, I don't know who I've messed up. I don't know what I've done wrong. I don't know who is punishing me, but whoever it is, I'm sorry, please stop. And in this type of situation, in this setting, God comes in and he says, I'm going to tell you what I want. I'm going to tell you exactly who I am. I'm going to tell you how this relationship's going to work. And people in that time would have been thinking, thank you. Thank you. You just laid it out. And the first four commandments are focused on the relationship between us and God.
Right.
And the last six are focused on us and each other. And that's why Jesus can come along and say, I've got the two greatest commandments. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And love your neighbor as yourself. And if you do these, he even says, all the law and the prophets hang on these two commands. Law and the prophets, the whole Old Testament. This is the community that we've laid down. In the back, and then we'll come up to the front. Yes?
Two questions. Okay. Mm-hmm. First one is the books, the Book of Life and the other books in Revelation 20, mm-hmm. and referring back to Daniel 7:10, mm-hmm. and talking about the same books.
Mm-hmm.
And what is this symbolism? Mm-hmm. What are we...
Yeah, if it's not symbolism, it gets a little crazy.
Yeah, it does.
And the reason why it gets a little crazy is because it's like, do I really think that there's this humongous book that all 7 billion people that are living right now, mm-hmm. all of their names, and he has to start up here, and then eventually throughout history, all the 50 billion people? No, what it is this. A lot of times the books like that were both in the ancient Near East as well as in the first century. They were registers, citizens' registers. Where in Rome, literally, you would have your name, if you're a Roman citizen, it would be written in a book and it would be put inside of the Roman treasury. It was kept safe. And if your name was in there, you were taken care of by Rome. That's what the whole point of it was. But the imagery, what is actually impacting from Daniel chapter 7, verses 9 through 10, and Revelation 20, as well as Revelation 2 and 3, when he brings the books up as well, is who is God? Who is God? Daniel chapter 7, 9 through 10, more than an event, it's describing who he is. He is the judge. He is the keeper of the registry. And he is the one that demarcates his citizens. He's in control, not us. He is. And so that's how the imagery impacts. And then obviously in Revelation chapter 20, 11 through 15, at the great judgment, he pulls out the books and he says, are you one of my citizens or not? And that's where it plays into the judgment scene. Because ultimately the king is the one that takes care of his citizens by keeping the citizen registry.
So when it says... And I saw the dead, the great and small, standing before the throne, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the Book of Life, and the dead were judged from the things which were written in the books according to their deeds.
Yeah. Ooh, did you hear that end part again? And deeds are stinking everywhere in Revelation. What it's saying is they do matter. Mm-hmm. We act like they don't, but they do. And in the scene of judgment, they come on the scene again. Yeah. You had a second question, or was that the second question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Second question mm-hmm. is, as a Bible teacher, I've sat under different mainstream, teachers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, like that. And in the area of Revelation, which has been a book I've tried to avoid most mm-hmm. of my life, but
you're not the only one, by the way.
I laid on my heart for some reason to embrace it.
Yeah.
But what I find, and you have brought a whole much more logical view of this, because you don't have to add numbers together, and I really appreciate that.
As an accountant.
It was no algebra up there on the board.
Then don't ask me about 666. Anyway, go ahead. That's right, you do.
But a lot of the mainline that we're seeing now, even in conservative and fundamentalists, is this Tim LaHaye dispensational whatever.
Okay. Yeah.
Which I'm getting more confused about.
As you should.
Okay. But when you're coming and you're teaching a mixed group of people from different backgrounds with many different preconceived notions and have sat under these many popular mainstream, very sound in many other areas of their doctrine, except for this, how do you keep unity in the Bible study and in the discussion?
Absolutely, that's a great question.
To the truth, but still being,
That's why I start out, every single time I talk of Revelation, I start with my first two principles. First two principles, we lay them down. This is the way in which we are going to progress in this discussion, because it's highly explosive, and I get that. Man, there's a lot of emotional involvement in this, tons of it, and I understand that. As a result, we're going to lay down the principle of humility, which says, I don't have it all figured out, but we're going to try to figure this out together. And then when we do it, we're going to do it with respect, and we're going to be unified. We're going to go home, we can disagree and still love Jesus. That's okay. It's okay for us to disagree. Nevertheless, when we disagree, you got to tell me why. Got to. Because otherwise, if you can't tell me why, then if you don't tell me why, then I feel like you're withholding me of growing in the truth. And I believe that God's entrusted His Word to a community. Not to me, to a community. And I need the community to help me interpret this. And I'm assuming that's the way that I'm interacting with you as well. So I lay down the principle of humility, and I lay down the principle of submission. And we're going to say, both of us, if we're going to do this, we're both going to submit to the Holy Spirit to be teaching us what He wants to say and not vice versa. And if we can agree on that, now we can go somewhere. And every time, whenever it gets heated, I'm going to say, I'm going to go back to these principles. I will fight for those principles, because in fighting for those principles, I'm fighting for you and I'm fighting for unity. However, what I do is a couple of things. Number one, when people have to go through a paradigm shift, it doesn't happen in one conversation in 1 hour. It's never the goal when I'm talking with people is to say, before we're done, you will have shifted every thought that you were thinking into mine. No. It took me 20 years to come to these conclusions, and only the last 10 have I been mining them. Therefore, I can't expect someone in a year or 2 years or 3 years to in any way, even if I am right, to come to this conclusion. Everybody needs time to grow. Everyone. And I'm assuming that in my growth period that I'm going to be being challenged of things I don't even know that's on my radar. That as soon as they get there, it's going to really cause me to have to change. And it's going to take time for me to really understand the implications of that. And so in this moment, number one, I deal with it very sensitively. I deal with tons of love and grace. I make fun of myself a lot. But at the same time, I also ask him questions. Like, what do I do with this passage? What do I do when the chronological roadmap doesn't seem to really work its way out? What do I do with that? What am I supposed to do? And if you can give me an answer that makes sense, then fine, I'll do that. Problem is, I don't know what to do with this information. And so until someone, matter of fact, I actually have a list of about 27 questions that I have that until dispensationalists answer these questions for me, then I can't entertain a shift. Because there's serious questions like, what do I do when Jesus says, I've come to establish a kingdom? Do I say that He failed? Got to answer that for me. That's a major problem for me. What do I do with the church, that it was God's unfortunate plan B? John the Baptist said that he was coming to establish a kingdom and that Jesus was me the one that does it. Was he wrong too? You know, what do I do whenever the Bible calls me kingdom of priests and I list out all the paths? I have serious questions that I want to have answered. And so I come at it from a student's perspective, because we're all learning at all times. We have to be lifelong learners. Otherwise, this community will never work. The moment someone's arrived is the moment that they probably are deviating from the gospel.
Or they're dead.
Yeah, or they're... Yeah. And even then, I believe in heaven we'll continue to learn. I really do. I believe in heaven we will continue to learn. Because I believe it's a gift from God.
So, why is... Well, I guess question... Why is this emphasis and almost obsession on the roadmap, the chronological timeline? And why is there this, okay, well, we've got this timeline for the church, and then we have this other timeline for Israel.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I've sat under teachers.
Uh-huh, me too.
Can kind of make it all look like...
Nice.
Yeah, nice. But, you know, you've got this...
And it gets difficult when you actually are reading the passages that are trying to support it. That's the problem.
That's where I've run into.
Yeah.
And so, what has brought all this...
Let me give you a history of the dispensational movement. Absolutely.
Revelation, that's what I'm finding is the main one.
Yeah, and let me give you a history of how that's become the main line. It's actually happened in the past 180 years. Before 1830, before a woman by the name of Margaret MacDonald went into a self-induced fever to develop a prophetic trance in Scotland in the presence of John Nelson Darby, no one in the history of the church had ever mentioned the word rapture, ever. It was mentioned for the first time ever 180 years ago. A man by the name from a woman named Margaret MacDonald. I have the letter that she wrote down in my notes, and if you email me, I can tell you where to find it in the book that I copied it out of, because I can't actually send it to you because there's copyright issues. But there's a book. It's actually called the book "The Incredible Cover Up," by Dave McPherson. And in it, he has the actual letter from Margaret MacDonald. When Margaret MacDonald went into her self-induced fever, she had this trance that she writes down in the letter, and the word rapture and the concept of rapture is the first time it ever appears, that goes before a 7 year of tribulation. John Nelson Darby was the one in the presence of her, and he took that and added the theological muscle to it. Over the next 20 years or so, he comes to America about 6 times, bringing this and also establishing a group known as the Plymouth Brethren that then began to influence their own people. And one of the people they primarily influenced was a guy by the name of Cyrus Scofield, who publishes the Scofield Reference Bible at the turn of the 20th century. Scofield Reference Bible influences a lot of people. One of the people that's influenced by this is a guy by the name of Dwight L. Moody, who establishes the Moody Bible Institute, which then perpetuates out. And Moody, being one of the most effective evangelists in the early 20th century, this doctrine starts to grow like wildfire. One of the people that eventually is influenced by Dwight L. Moody is a guy by the name of Billy Graham, who wrote the book Approaching Hoofbeats in the very beginning of the 1970s and in the 60s. Billy Graham has since recanted on this belief, but he did write the book. Hal Lindsey was the next one then to pick up the thing in the 1970s. The book The Late Great Planet Earth outsells the Bible in the decade. Hal Lindsey then, once the 1970s, is picked up by Edgar Wise in 1988, 88 Reasons Why the Rapture Will Happen in 1988. That eventually doesn't happen. Some disenchantment occurs, but in the 90s, thankfully, I depend on how you define the word thankfully, a guy by the name of Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins puts in a fictitious novel this belief that is now the dominant belief in 180 years of what the church thinks about Revelation. That's the history. And the problem is, before 1800, we don't have this doctrine at all. That's a red flag for me.
But, I mean, we have... you've got major Bible scholars buying into this.
Yeah.
And for me, is this you know, little accountant trying to figure this out, I feel like... Who am I to disprove these, you know, scholars and doctors and PhDs?
You're a sister in Christ. Okay. That's who you are. That belongs to the community that's supposed to be consistently policing and helping us look for what is right. Because this is one of the problems of ignoring all of church history. Man, if we ignore the Old Testament, we ignore church history, we can get away with a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Perhaps that's what they did with each other, too. Well, he said it was so, so it must be.
Yeah.
So let me put some more things behind it.
Exactly. And that's where it comes back to saying, but,
right.
What does the Bible say about the rapture? What does the Bible say about the tribulation? Can we ask that question real quick? What the Bible says about the rapture? Because there's actually three major passages for the rapture that they do point to. One of them is Revelation chapter 4, verse 1. I'm sorry I even have to read this. The only reason why I have to read this is because in the Scofield Reference Bible, it says Revelation 4, verse 1 is one of, if not the most clear references to the rapture in the whole Bible. Problem is, it's somewhat laughable.
Yeah.
After this I looked, and there before me was a door standing open in heaven. And the voice I had first heard speaking to me like a trumpet said, "Come up here, and I will show you what must take place after this." That's the rapture in Revelation. The words "come up here." See the problem?
I popped out of my car driving down the road for that.
Let me read you though the more influential one, the more well known one. That comes 1 Corinthians 4, 13 and following is one that's pretty important. We can deal with that one now, that's fine. This one is a little bit, we'll talk about why I think it's misguided in a minute. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, 13 through 18. This isn't the one you popularly hear most quoted. We'll get to that one in a minute. That's in Matthew 24. This one, though, is 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, 13 through following. It says, "Brothers, we do not want you to be ignorant about those who fall asleep." What does the words "fall asleep" mean there?
Die.
Who has died?
Christians,
their Christian brothers and sisters have died. "Brothers, we don't want you to be ignorant about those that have fallen asleep, or to grieve like the rest of men who have no hope." What's the context here? Christians in Thessalonica are being persecuted, and people have even led to death. And he's saying, I don't want you to be ignorant about what's happened to them. Because some people may be asking the question, if we aren't alive when Jesus comes back, do we get to take part in the second coming? He says, I don't want you to be ignorant about your brothers and sisters that have died. I'm going to tell you where they're at. I'm going to tell you how they fit into the second coming. That's the issue at hand. Does everybody follow me on that? Okay. Now, we can force rapture into this, or we can allow this text just to tell us what it wants to say.
But we're taking it out of context.
Yes, exactly. And we'll get to that in a moment. That's exactly right. Verse 14. "We believe that Jesus died and rose again. And so we believe that God will bring with Jesus those who have fallen asleep in Him." You hear what he says? We believe in the resurrection. Therefore, those that have died, that have fallen asleep, we believe that Jesus is the hope, that He will take care of them. And when He comes back, they will be with Him. We will reunite. According to the Lord's own word, we tell you that we who are still alive, who are left till the coming of the Lord, will certainly not precede those who have fallen asleep. As a matter of fact, those that have died will actually be first to be with Jesus before you. He says, I'm telling you, your loved ones are in good hands. "For the Lord Himself will come down from heaven with a loud command, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trumpet call of God." So much for a silent rapture.
Yeah.
Oops. That was a little too loud, Jesus. You need to be more quiet. "And the dead in Christ will rise first." The dead will rise first. Sounds like the resurrection from John 5, where everyone will rise and then be judged, does it not? Kind of sounds like the end of everything. Right? "After that, we who are still alive and are left will be caught up together with Him in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air." We have three groups. The dead, the resurrected, the ones that are with Jesus, they're coming together, and the ones that are on earth, all converging for what? For the end of everything to begin. But we force rapture into this. Meet Him in the air. What is that for? Matter of fact, the word "meet" is a pretty interesting word. It's the word apontasis in the Greek. And it's a word that we actually find in Acts chapter 27. Whenever Paul is on his way to Rome, and the Christians at three taverns, they couldn't hold it in. They go out and they apontasis Paul. They meet him. So that then they can stay with him there for 7 years? So they can bring him back to Rome. The word "meet" means to meet. Literally, it was used in imperial context to talk about when the king is coming to your city. You go out. You don't even let him get into your city yet. You go out, you meet him, and then you come into the city. If that is the definition of this word, Then the meeting Jesus in the air is for what reason? So that we can all come back together on a new heavens and a new earth to live for eternity.
So it's not for a 7-year marriage supper.
We have to force any of the 7-year, any of the rapture theology into this passage for it to make sense. And that was not the purpose of this passage to begin with. It was never the purpose of this passage. The purpose of this passage was to comfort the people whose loved ones has died. And to say they are with Jesus. And we will be too. You can bank on that. And that's why it ends in verse 18 when it says, therefore encourage each other with these words. How would he encourage each other with these words if he's talking about some future rapture 2,000 years from now that has nothing to do with them? You see the problem? And you know what else is very ironic for our date setters that use this passage for the rapture? Is the very next verse. Now, brothers, about times and dates, we don't need to write to you, for you know very well that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. I mean, really? Can it be more comical? Oh, it gets better, though. Turn to Matthew chapter 24. Oh, man. Context is just it just messes everything up. Matthew chapter 24, verse 36. Talking about the second coming. No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. As it was in the days of Noah. Ah, Old Testament. So it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. Who was taken away? All the evil people, right? Was it not? That who's the ones that stayed on the earth? Noah and his family. And the flood came and swept all the evil people away. Let's keep reading. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two will be in the field, one will be taken, the other left. Two women will be grinding with the handmill, one will be taken, the other left. Heard that one? Here's the problem. In context, who's taken?
The evil.
The evil. Even their rapture's taking the wrong people. According to context in Matthew chapter 24. See the problem? Man, we ignore context. We can do whatever we want. The first major red flag for me of rapture is the fact that it only started 180 years ago. The second one is whenever I actually look at the passages and realize what they're saying is the exact opposite. Because what the Bible says is, we will be left behind because we're still going to live in this place. Purified with fire, mind you. But it's going to look awful familiar. You're not going to be these beings that are floating. When you try to give a hug, you pass right through them. You're not going to be fat little babies sitting on clouds playing harps for eternity. We're not going to sit in a big coliseum and transparency after transparency, we're singing like canaries. That's not what's going to happen. What's going to happen is God created a creation and he called it good. And then it got really bad. And because of Jesus, one day he will look at it and he'll say, it's good again. So therefore, be merry, have fun, enjoy the earth I created for you, church, for you. Man, at that point, it becomes really beautiful, and you're not looking for this moment where we fly up in the sky and planes aren't crashing because the pilots leave. And instead, we're looking for the moment whenever Jesus says, okay, it's all over. It's time for judgment because you guys have lived enough tribulation. Because you guys have lived enough persecution. Is this making sense? One of the reasons why the rapture concerns me a lot. Oh man, people come up with the weirdest things. One of my really good friend, his really good friend. How's that for you? For evidence. His really good friend refuses to fully submit his life to Jesus so he can stay during the time of the tribulation and point people to Jesus. I see his heart. Problem is, it's crazy theology. That's making him come to some weird conclusions. You know, one of the other things that really bothers me about dispensationalism? Man, I get a little bit upset when you start changing who Jesus is and what he accomplished. It makes me a little bit irritated. And I was talking to dispensationalists about the reinstitution of the temple during the 1,000-year reign and sometimes during the 7-year tribulation, depending on which dispensationalist you're talking to, because they don't exactly agree. The reinstitution of the sacrifice I have a problem with. Because it comes from Ezekiel 40 through 48 is where they get the reinstitution of the temple and the reinstitution of sacrifices. And in Ezekiel 40 through 48, the sacrifices that are there are sacrifices of atonement. And I said, why in the world are we reinstituting a temple to reinstitute sacrifices of atonement? And I'm not kidding. His response was, because during that time period, what Jesus accomplished on the cross will be suspended. And I looked at him and I said, that's, friend, where we part ways. I said, because Hebrews says pretty clearly it doesn't get suspended. And what Jesus accomplished will resonate throughout all of eternity with no hiatus. When you start messing with who Jesus is and what Jesus has accomplished, that's whenever I start to stand my ground and say, show me. I want to know where it says that this is a sacrifice that's for eternity with a caveat. Where's the footnote? Where is it? But man, this leads to all kinds of dangerous theology. Dangerous theology like, man, we're just going to do whatever we want to the earth. We're just going to destroy it. Why? Because ultimately it's just going to be left over for those people in the tribulation anyway. So God creates creation, calls it good, and then we get to just destroy it and do whatever we want with it? That's the agreement we walked into? Really? God's cool if we just, you know, pollute the earth, just whatever we want. It's for us. Really? That's the message of the Bible? That's what He's entrusted us? Romans chapter 8, when it says that all of creation is groaning and longing for the point whenever the bondage will be lifted from it, the decay that it was subjected to is longing for the sons of God to be revealed so that it too can be released. That's the creation I get to just destroy and do whatever I want with. I believe that Jesus died on the cross to restore you and all of creation. Therefore, the way I interact with creation should say something about the way in which I look at God too. Man, if you're going to be raptured out of here in a couple years anyway, might as well just... I need to be careful with the words I say there. Might as well just destroy the earth and do with it whatever you want.
Well, it's going to be purified by fire anyway. Come on, Shane.
Yeah. And since that's the case, I can do whatever I want to God's creation. It just doesn't work that way.
It's kind of like Galatians. We can just sin all we want because God forgives
us. Yeah. Is that what grace does? By no means. Yeah. We're called to be better than that.
Question.
I promised up here first, and then we will move around. Yes. Go ahead. I do need a drink.
Why were there 24 elders and not 12 or 17? What's this 24 stand for?
Yeah, good question. First of all, you did notice that it is a derivative of 12. And there's several theories about this. Number one, some people believe that it is the 24 elders symbolizes the 12 tribes as well as the 12 disciples being the people of God. Now, that does not mean a conflation of ethnic Israel and the church called Israel. That is a totally different issue. So they would say symbolically it's talking to the complete people of God. Or, this is what I find very interesting. At the time of Domitian, the emperor that's reigning during the time of Revelation, he did something very interesting. Traditionally, there are anywhere from 6 to 8 lictors that were surrounding him. And the lictors were the people they would herald whenever he would come in. They would also wield rods, and if people needed to be punished, they would be punished. In the time of Domitian, it's fascinating that these lictors, he increased to 24. And there were 24 lictors that surrounded him at all times, not only yelling out his praises, but also divvying out the punishment. Ultimately, it's a symbol. Symbols have multiple layers, and they can be multiple things at the same time. And I think it's probably a little bit of both.
Also, why does God let Satan live on earth to like torture us and terrorize the people?
Mm-hmm.
Like, me and my mom had a couple of theories.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
go ahead.
Last night, my theory is that God let Satan live on earth to like. Not on purposely torture people to let them be tortured, but like there's a reason behind letting them torture. It's like dominoes. The devil starts the dominoes by terrorizing people, and they go and go and go till finally it gets to the point where it has to stop, and God stops it.
Yeah, you know, I heard different forms of that question a lot after May 22nd down in Joplin. when a tornado happens and 160 people get wiped out and we lose 7,000 homes and 300 businesses, man, one of the key questions is, why did God let this happen? One of the things that blew me away was watching the spiritual battle that was occurring in the tornado. Some really weird stories came out of the tornado. For example, a lot of kids that were watching the tornado, they would talk about all the butterflies that were inside of the tornado. Very interesting, because what a lot of the adults talked about was when the blackness came. Matter of fact, there was a really interesting story. This lady was inside of St. John's. It's one of our hospitals that got wiped away.
We're familiar with his family.
Yeah.
We're families from
that. No kidding. Okay, so we have a connection. One of the ladies was holding on to the hand of her three-year-old son, and he got sucked into the tornado. And about a day and a half later, they found him about three-quarters of a mile away from where he was, walking around. And they got the three-year-old boy and reunited him with his mom, and the doctor was, you know, trying to make them consoled. And after time went past, he asked him, he said, do you remember what happened? And the boy said, yeah. He said, the angel picked me up and set me down over there. And then he hung out with me until you guys found me. And story after story, we're in the middle of this destruction of Satan. You have God moving, and it is changing so many lives. People from all over the world have come to Joplin to work, and because of the way the church has responded in Joplin, and I say the church singularly, even though we have a couple hundred churches in Joplin.
There was a church that was completely wiped away, and the only thing that was left was a 3-foot tall cross.
It was on 26th Street, and I've actually met the Catholic priest that was there. But this is what's been amazing. I go to College Heights Christian Church, and we had like 6 Sundays in a row where this guy from Chicago who came down just to help with the tornado was so overwhelmed with the love of the church that he gave his life to Christ. And the very next week we had a guy that was from Australia that came just to help out for the tornado, and he was so overwhelmed by the church that he gave his life to Christ. And then we had, and all of a sudden I stopped and I said, this is interesting, because in the middle of the storm we see a war. And in this destruction, whenever Satan thought, man, like the cross, I've won, all of a sudden God says, actually, the way in which you think you win is the way in which my kingdom advances. In the book of Acts, whenever persecution came on the church, you know what happened? The church left Jerusalem and spread it to the ends of the earth because of persecution. And every time you see persecution in the book of Acts, shortly thereafter, there's a little phrase that says, and the church grew. That's why Tertullian, an early church father, says that the seed of the church is the blood of the saints. And so what we look at as Satan torturing us and winning, God looks at and he says, you don't see, I'm actually winning. Because what the cross does is really amazing. The key weapon of Satan is suffering and death. And now that Jesus conquered death, every time he kills us, it actually turns the weapon on him. He's taken his number one weapon, and now it's the number one way we advance. So, I don't know how to answer that question. And a lot of times people that are in suffering, they don't look at it as being tortured. They look at it as the kingdom advancing.
Because I remember when 9/11, when we were at church on a Sunday, and we went over a video on 9/11, because that was at reunion. And I told my mom, I think that God let Satan bomb the Twin Towers, and for some reason behind the bombing, God, if you see 9/11, God's magic is working right after it was done. There are millions of people, firefighters, going inside, saving people, God's work. There were millions of people who were with their families, helping out, picking up the destruction and everything. And God's magic was on that day, and he was using it.
And it's one of the things, too.
He turns it to good.
He does, and we're addicted to the word why. Why does God let this, or why did God do this, or why did... And Job asked that question a lot, too. And ultimately, God looks back at us, he says, you're asking the wrong question. you're asking the wrong question. And what does God do? He say, he looks at Job and he says, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Where were you? Have you seen the storehouses of snow that I use to pour out on this earth? Where were you when the Leviathan was called forth from the crevices of the rocks? Where were you? Ultimately, what he's doing is this. He's saying, do you know who I am? And trust me. You don't need to know why. You just need to know who. If you know who, you're good to go. You're good to go. Good question. Yes?
I have three questions, and I'll try to make them short.
Absolutely, it's fine.
Just give me a short answer.
We got time. Okay. Is this yes or no? Or no, I'm just kidding. No. Yes. No.
I don't think so. One, God places a seal on his believers, and Satan puts a mark on his followers.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? Identifying the mark is not as important as identifying the purpose of the mark.
Yeah.
Those who accept it show their allegiance to Satan. Can I assume, since they're not visible, that it's by the deeds?
Yes. People? Yes. You've solved the mark of the beast. I'm not even kidding.
Okay, so you answered that one.
Yes. Okay. And I'm so, what's so exciting about that is that something as complicated as the mark of the beast that so many people get wrong, when you actually look in Revelation through the right lens, it's pretty simple. So job well done.
Okay.
Don't even need to read that chapter of the book.
Okay, then the other one is the 144,000 represent the believers who have endured persecution on earth. That's not very many people when you consider the number of people.
If we measure them, it isn't. But if we weigh them, it is. It's completeness, the complete number of God's people.
Well, the 12 tribes and 12,000 in each tribe. And we're talking Jewish tribes.
Maybe.
Gentiles fit in.
Exactly. And that's why if it was the exact 12 tribes of Israel from the Old Testament, then that would make sense. Here's the problem. This is where some of the rubber meets the road on the dispensational issue as well as the New Testament. Matthew does something very fascinating in his gospel. He's constantly paralleling to the Old Testament with Jesus and what he's fulfilling. As a matter of fact, if you trace the Exodus motif from the beginning of Matthew, you can see it all the way throughout, that Jesus is the new Moses. And what happens is, at the very beginning, for example, whenever Moses and Jesus are both born, Moses and Jesus both were persecuted as little boys, were under the age of two. All the children are being wiped out. And yet, God miraculously saves them by taking them both right into Egypt. Remember I told you Jews think cyclically? There's a reason why this is the reason why Matthew's surfacing this. Then what happens is then right after that in chapter 3 of Matthew, you have the baptism of Jesus that occurs. And one of the key monumental moments of Moses' ministry is the passing through the waters of the Red Sea. And Jesus passed through the waters, and Moses leads the people of God through the waters straight into the wilderness. And Jesus, in Matthew chapter 3, verse 17, chapter 4, verse 1, Jesus is led straight into the wilderness to face Satan. And the three temptations are the same. Jesus is there for 40 days, they're there for 40 years. They're complaining about food, Jesus tempted with food. And Jesus quotes three passages that all come from Deuteronomy that are pointing to the failure of Israel to trust who God is in the wilderness to provide for them. And where Israel failed, Jesus succeeded. Therefore, he's not just the new Moses, he is the true Israel. So then what's fascinating this to me is that once the wilderness gets moving, what the wilderness leads us to in the story of Moses and the story of Israel is to Mount Sinai, where the commandments, God's law is given. And right after chapter 4, you lead right into chapter 5 of Matthew, which is the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' law. Then right after, you get the Sermon on the Mount, or you get the Mount Sinai, they then lead into the land of Canaan and start taking the promised land. And in chapters 8 and 9 of Matthew, right after the Sermon on the Mount, you have 12 miracles. And I don't think that's on accident. Because Jesus is saying, I am taking over the promised land, but I'm doing it through God's power in me by loving people. So all that to say this, if Jesus is the true Israel, and then you have chapter 10 when Matthew, where he chooses 12 disciples. What is he creating? All of the Old Testament was pointing to the fulfillment. Israel was never the goal. Now hear me very carefully when I'm saying that, because I could be accused of saying something I'm not saying. Israel is so important because of what they brought about. Here's the problem. I believe that But we exalt Israel today to a level that is not what the New Testament teaches. Because here's what happens. Romans chapter 9, verse 6. Let's read that. That's important. This is very Pauline theology. This has a lot to do with our identity, and if we don't know who we are, then we may not act the way we're supposed to act. Romans chapter 9, which I believe is the climax, 9 through 11 is the climax of this entire book. Romans chapter 9, verse 1, Paul says this, I speak the truth in Christ, I'm not lying. My conscience confirms it in the Holy Spirit. I have great sorrow and unceasing anguish in my heart. Why? He'll tell us. For I could wish that I myself were cursed and cut off from Christ for the sake of my brothers, those of my own race, the people of Israel. I wish I could cut myself off for them. Because theirs is the adoption as sons. Theirs is the divine glory, the covenants, the receiving of the law, the temple worship, and the promises. Theirs are the patriarchs, and from them is traced the human ancestry of Christ, who is God over all forever. Praised, amen. Then verse 6. It is not as though God's word had failed. For not all who are descended from Israel are Israel. What did he say there? It's not about ethnicity. It's about Jesus. Who is Israel? Israel, by definition, is the name of God's people. And all of the New Testament is wrestling with the issue, how do the Gentiles fit if they're not of our blood? And it says it's not blood of ethnicity that matters, it's the blood of Jesus. It's not the circumcision of the foreskin, it's the circumcision of the heart. He says, matter of fact, not all who claim to be Israel are Israel. And he says it in Galatians as well. Turn to Galatians chapter 3. Galatians chapter 3. Let's just start in verse 1 because I like it when Paul gets a little rowdy. You foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you? Before your very eyes, Jesus Christ was clearly portrayed as crucified. I would like to learn just one thing from you. Did you receive the Spirit by observing the law or by believing what you heard? Are you so foolish? After beginning with the Spirit, are you now trying to attain your goal by human effort? Have you suffered so much for nothing if it really was for nothing? Does God give you a Spirit and work miracles among you because you observe the law or because you believe what you heard? The issue he's dealing with in Galatians is Jew-Gentile relations. Verse 6. Consider Abraham. He believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness. Understand then that those who believe are the children of Abraham. How do we define Israel? By those who believe. You're covered. You are defined as Israel if you're covered with the blood of Jesus. You keep reading. The Scriptures foresaw that God would justify the Gentiles by faith and announce the gospel in advance to Abraham. All nations will be blessed through you. So those who have faith are blessed along with Abraham, the man of faith. It's very fascinating to me that 1 Corinthians chapter 10, whenever he's talking to a predominantly Gentile church, he says, it's just like our forefathers. And he starts talking about Moses and those in the wilderness. Wait a minute. Ethnically, that's not their forefathers. You don't understand. My lineage doesn't go through ethnicity. My lineage goes through Jesus. And if He is the true Israel, then when I follow Him, I am fulfilled Israel. I'm what Israel was always supposed to be. What Israel was always supposed to be. That's why Revelation chapter 2:9 and 3:9 says, those that claim to be Jews but are not. That's what He says. Why? Because they're claiming to be the people of God, but ethnicity is not what gets you to be the people of God. Jesus does.
That even goes back to Romans 9:8.
Exactly.
Where it says, in other words, it is not the natural children who are God's children, but it is the children of the promise who are regarded as Abraham.
Yes. And with that theology in place, when we come to Revelation 7 and we see the 12 tribes, who really is Israel? The church.
Now it's clear.
Church.
Okay. Yes. The church. So this is my exhortation to all of us. We have got to understand that the Jews in Israel are lost without Jesus. They are our mission field. And if we tell them they get a free pass and they don't, what have we done? You see the problem?
That answered that question terrific. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, absolutely.
Now, several of us had the question during break time regarding the letters in Revelation. Mm-hmm. Because we understood you to say that there was one letter written. But we're reading in Revelation where it says, let me get back to Revelation
again. Absolutely, yeah, no problem. Matter of fact, I'll take a drink while you're doing it. So you're actually buying me time. I appreciate that. Not a problem at all. Ooh, that tastes so good.
At first, it says to the seven churches, which sounds like one letter.
Yeah.
Then when you go to chapter 2, it says to the
angel of the church of Ephesus.
Right.
Yeah.
Then to the angel of the church in Smyrna. Right.
Yeah.
So it sounds like they're individual letters that are being written. So are there seven letters within the one book of Revelation that's being written?
Yeah, the book of Revelation would have gone to Ephesus in the form that we have it. And then the person that would have got it before the church would have read the whole book from front to back. They would have heard to the angel of the church of Ephesus, and then they read. And then they would have heard to the angel of the church of Smyrna. They would have heard the message for all their brothers and sisters. It's a circular letter. So the same message is read at every single one of them. And it's not seven letters within. It is one big letter that all the congregations would have read to each other.
So when it got to Smyrna, they would have read the letter to Ephesus.
Yeah, they would have read it from back to forward.
Read verse 11. Chapter 1, verse 11.
Chapter 1, verse 11. You can go ahead and read it.
Saying, write in a book what you see and send it to the seven churches. To Ephesus,
yep.
And Smyrna.
Okay.
So yeah. He's writing one book of what you see.
Absolutely.
These things, and sending it all.
And this was a very normal thing. As a matter of fact, even the book of Ephesians says, and pass this on to the Laodiceans.
Okay.
This is a very normal thing. Matter of fact, one of the reasons why is because writing on scrolls was so expensive.
Yeah.
Oh, my word. First of all, you had to find somebody that could write. Then you had to pay for all the materials. Then you had to pay for it to then be going to all the different cities. And so at that point, it's like, why would I write seven individual big letters when I could write one big one and it'd be read at every place? So there is some practical economic reasons of why you'd do it. Nevertheless, that is what the normal tradition was as well.
Make sure they all get the same message.
Yeah, and you know what? Somebody in the church of...
different problems.
Yeah, exactly. And somebody in the church of Smyrna would have said, I don't have the problem you described about us, but boy, Ephesus hit me square between the eyes. And that's what I find a lot. When we're in the book of... when I'm looking at the book of Revelation, I'm going, man, I see myself in Laodicea. I see myself in Sardis.
Not as bad as theirs.
Yeah, they could do that. And then there'd be another rebuke that'd have to come on top of that.
We're not in that church.
Yeah. Boy, Laodicea is messed up. They're going to be vomited out. Yes.
Listening to the discussion from the questions, are we as Christians throughout the world, not the church, but as a people, we're not Jewish, but can we consider ourselves as being Israel?
We are fulfilled Israel. See, now, there's a that first word is really important to me. Because some people will try to accuse me of replacement theology. Oh, you're saying you're the new Israel? No. I am saying that if this is the church, and this was God's goal, that was God's goal, that I believe what he calls Israel did this. I don't believe we've replaced anything. I think we are what the Old Testament was pointing to. We are what Israel was supposed to be. Therefore, whenever I say, no, the church is Israel, I'm not saying we've replaced anything. I'm saying that God, through Jesus, has fulfilled what Israel was always supposed to be.
I wasn't trying to say we replaced it.
Yeah.
That we'd be considered part of it.
Yeah, we were grafted in. Absolutely. And that's Romans chapter 10. That follows right after 9. He describes how this happened. Nevertheless, not only were we grafted in, some were lopped off.
Is that my Bible?
As a matter of fact, this is pretty interesting too. Turn with me, I think it's Matthew 19. If it's not there, then we'll go to Mark chapter 12. But I think it's Matthew 19. It's always nice whenever you have it in multiple places. So if you don't remember it in one, you can remember it in the other gospel. I like that. It's Matthew chapter 20. No, it's not. Let's go to Mark chapter 12. Yeah. Mark chapter 12. Because I don't know where it is in Matthew right now. It'll be quicker this way. Mark chapter 12, verse 1. He then began to speak to them in parables. Let me give you the context here. Jesus, in chapter 11, has just gone through the triumphal entry. He's walked into the temple the first day he gets there, and in Mark's gospel, he looks around and walks away. Everybody's like, what happened? The next day, he's walking to the temple. He sees a fig tree. He goes up to it, wants a bite to eat. It doesn't have any fruit, and so he says, curse you, even though it wasn't in the season of figs. We'll get to that later. Then he goes to the cleansing of the temple, and he walks in, he cleanses the temple, and he indicts them for turning the temple into a place in which, instead of bringing in the Gentiles, they're using it as a fortress from which to fight them. Matter of fact, that's actually the word whenever he says, you've turned my house into a den of robbers. The word for robbers is actually laistes, which is a word that you can, that's actually most accurately translated political revolutionary or insurrectionist or guerrilla warriors. You've turned the house of God into a fortress to fight wars against the Gentiles. Instead of being a light to the Gentiles, you're the light that burns the Gentiles. He says that's the problem. So then, after cleansing the temple, stopping sacrifices in the temple at the time of Passover by driving out all of the people selling the sacrifices, thereby pronouncing judgment on it, he then goes in the end of chapter 11 or with the withered fig tree, and they go, and the one that he cursed right before he went to cleanse the temple, now Peter's astonished because it's gone. Now, if you know that fig tree is a symbol in the Old Testament for the nation of Israel when it was not in rebellion, a flourishing fig tree is the way that Zechariah describes the nation of Israel when they're producing the fruit that God wants from them. And when they stop producing the fruit, that fig tree all of a sudden is then under judgment. You realize that the withering of the fig tree, the cursing of the fig tree, is really describing the same thing as the cleansing of the temple. And that is, because of what you have done, you're not bearing the fruit of God, therefore you will be judged. That's brutal. Matter of fact, this is what's interesting. If you look in verse 22. Have faith in God. I tell you the truth. If any one of you says to this mountain, go throw yourself into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says will happen, it will be done for him. This is what's fascinating. Where is Jesus? He's standing next to the Temple Mount. He says, if you tell this mountain to go throw it into the sea, you believe that God will do it, it will be done. There's a reason why chapter 11, the pronouncement of the judgment on the temple and on Jerusalem because of their rebellion, leads eventually to chapter 13, which describes the destruction of the temple. Okay, you following the track here? Then, right after this, they question his authority, say, by what authority are you saying these ridiculous things? Jesus says, let me ask you a question. By what authority did John the Baptist have his ministry? They knew they had a problem, because if they said his ministry was from God, Then Jesus would say, why didn't you believe in him? Because if they believe in John the Baptist, then they believe in Jesus. But if they say he's not from God, they were afraid of the people, because all the people accepted he was a prophet. So they look back at him and they say, we don't know. And Jesus says, well, I'm not going to answer your question. And then Jesus, in chapter 12, the parable of the vineyard, or the parable of the tenants, answers their question, which is great. A man planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a pit for the winepress, and built a watchtower. This is pretty important because it parallels Isaiah chapter 5. We need to turn over there and read that real quick. Isaiah chapter 5, verses 1 through 5. Notice what we're doing. I'm building the context. I'm putting in all the pieces to get to the answer of this question, because I think Jesus answers it for us. Chapter 5, God's writing. I will sing for the one I love a song about his vineyard. Why does Jesus use vineyard in his parable? Because he's pointing to something in Isaiah. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted with the choicest vines. Sounds like Jesus' parable, doesn't it? He built a watchtower in it and cut a wine press as well. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. Remember the fig tree being cursed? Verse 3, now you dwellers in Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. You be the judge. What more could I have done for my vineyard than what I have done for it? What more could I have done? Why, when I looked for good grapes, did it only yield bad? Now I will tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge, and it will be destroyed. I will break down its wall, and it will be trampled. I will make it a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, and briars and thorns will grow there. I will command the clouds not to rain on it. Then he says this, verse 7, the vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the house of Israel. Mark chapter 12. A man planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a pit for the wine press, and built a watchtower. Well, that sounds familiar. A passage we're not really fond of, as the Jewish elite would say. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and went away on a journey. At harvest time, he sent a servant. The Greek word there is doulos, or slave. Matter of fact, in the Old Testament, this word is attached to the prophets more than any other people. This word, doulos, the servants of God. The prophets, the servants of God. It says he sent them a servant to the tenants to collect from them some of the fruit of the vineyard. But they seized him, beat him, and sent him away empty-handed. How did Israel treat God's prophets? They beat him. They killed him. Got rid of him. He says, the vineyard owner sends a doulos. And what do you do to him? Same thing you always did to him. Verse 4, then he sent another servant to them. They struck this man on the head and treated him shamefully. It's really interesting because in Mark's Gospel in chapter 6, we have this one key person that's introduced in chapter 1 as a prophet by the name of John the Baptist. And the way the nation of Israel treated him was killing him by cutting his head off. He sent still another, and they killed that one. He sent many others. Some of them they beat, others they killed. He had one left to send, a son whom he loved. He sent him last of all, saying, although respect my son. But the tenants said to one another, this is the heir. Come, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. So they took him and killed him and threw him outside of the vineyard. What then will the owner of the vineyard do? Kind of sounds like Isaiah 5. Judge between me and my vineyard. He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. What's the vineyard represent? House of Israel. You see what God's saying to the, you want to know how the Jewish people react to this? Verse 12, then they looked for a way to arrest him because they knew he had spoken the parable against them. What Jesus is saying is this. Nation of Israel, I've called you to be something that you've habitually rejected. And no matter what I did for you, I dug the wine press, I set up the watchtower, I did everything I could. And whenever I came for fruit, what did I find? Bad fruit. Every time. So I sent my servants, and what did you do to them? You killed them. And now I've sent my son, and what will you do to him? Kill him. Because that's what you will do. I'm taking the vineyard from you and giving it to the ones that will bear fruit. It's not a hop, skip, and a jump to understand that the church is what Israel was always supposed to be. We are the vineyard that is supposed to be bearing the fruit. And that's where deeds comes into the conversation again. So you see how this makes sense? Man, if you understand that you are God's people, that you are the ones that have the message of Christ to save the world, it may affect the way you live. What breaks my heart is that some people think, matter of fact, one of the interpretations from the dispensational perspective is on Matthew 25, the sheep and the goats is not about how you treat those outside. It's you'll be separating sheep and goats based on how you treat Israel. What? What? How does that find its way into this? Because in order for that to be true, I have to ignore Romans and Galatians and Revelation 2:9 and Revelation 3:9 and Mark chapter 12 and the whole point of the cross, the fact he appoints 12 disciples. Eventually, I might just need to stop and say, maybe we're fulfilled Israel. Maybe nothing broke. But maybe Israel's lack of bearing fruit. When Jesus came, he said, the vineyard's going to be taken from you. You know, whenever you get to Mark or Romans chapter 10, he talks about the cutting off of the branches that weren't bearing any fruit and grafting in the ones that will. That's what Jesus just said in the parable of the vineyard. Same thing. It's a very consistent message about who we are in relationship to God. And man, when we know who we are, we'll know what to do. Yes?
This helps make the connection that if I give the vineyard to others, that phrase, now I make the connection of Paul meeting Christ on the road to Damascus is how the start of the gospel taken to the Gentiles.
Yeah, and you know what's, and the one that brings us this rich theology about the identity of the church as Israel is Paul, a Pharisee of Pharisees. Absolutely. That to me is the most incredibly explosive irony of all of it. Is that who are the ones leading the charge to kill Jesus? The Jewish elite, and the Pharisees were a big push in that. I actually think it is highly probable that Paul probably did interact with Jesus at some point during his ministry, lobbing bombs, or at least next to his teacher, Gamaliel, who may have been lobbing some of those bombs. It's very possible. One of the reasons why Paul was so excited about persecuting the Christians whenever they started to really explode. Carrying on the ministry of his mentor. Yes, really quick, and then I'll come up here. Yes?
This kind of a little different vein here.
Mm-hmm.
Are you aware, Shane, of anyone that has begun or is working on putting together a book of some sort, just, you know, like a study guide for the book of Revelation, where it flat out lists, okay, here's the NIV version of the book of Revelation,
mm-hmm.
and then they take these hard words or symbols and actually replace them in a language that you can actually read the entire book without having to strain.
Huh.
Not.
No, but that's a great idea.
But I'm thinking in my mind, you know, it might be less fearful to others to have a book where they can read it and go, oh, that makes some sense. Now I can study it backwards and understand, you know, where you can compare.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think that's a great idea, and maybe one day I'll jot it down and get to work on it. But I will say this.
There's nothing in print right now.
Not that I'm aware of. But what I will say real quick, though, is it's not where what you're describing, but this little column in between helps out huge. Because whenever I'm reading through Revelation, and I'm thinking, where have I heard that before? Oh, Isaiah 26. It says right there. Okay. The Old Testament cross-references, if you have a study Bible, or especially if they list in the middle, that is so important for Revelation. Matter of fact, what is interesting is my mentor that passed away in April, he taught Revelation over at a place called TCM, House Edelweiss, over in Eastern Europe. And he gave his students one day Revelation 11. He photocopied it out of a study Bible without telling them anything. And he said, all I want you to do is to use the study Bible, and I want you to find every image in there. He said, what was amazing is they found everyone, and they were all right. Why? Because they just looked at the Old Testament context and used that to govern their interpretation. So until that comes out, that's what you can do right now. But that's a good idea. That would be handy. Be convenient. I like that. Yeah, I'll write that down. Joe?
Well, I'd use the King James Version.
Uh-huh. We can talk about that another time.
could you explain what Paul meant in 1 Corinthians 15
mm-hmm.
when he said, let me tell you a mystery?
Yeah, the word mystery is matter of fact, in Pauline literature, mystery is always attached to the revealing of Jesus. Always. You know what is a mystery? And what's such a weird mystery that people, even in 1 Corinthians 1, call it foolishness? Is how the cross could accomplish overthrowing the violent king of Satan. That's a mystery. That God's now revealed to us in these times. That you want to know how I'm going to win? How I'm going to bring the wrongs back to right? It's going to look like this. A bloody mess. Where the whole world's going to look like we're destroyed. Well, that doesn't make any sense. I love, man, I was even talking to Justin and them at in 1 Corinthians 1. This is probably the passage that right now I'm just fixated on. Yeah, let's read it. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 18. Oh, actually, let's do verse 17. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with the words of human wisdom, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. The power of the cross is what we're talking about, which is a mystery. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. The message of the cross is foolishness to those that are perishing. But to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. You know what's foolishness about this? How do you plan to stop the violent king of Satan with by getting you allowing yourself to violently be destroyed by it? To those that are perishing, that's stupid. You can't overthrow violence with a cross. There's no way. And he looks at us and he says, no, actually, for those of us who are being saved, this is the power of God. Because if God doesn't do it, it won't happen. And then he goes on and he says, for it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know Him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those of us who believe. I love it when people say, what you're saying makes absolutely no sense. You mean it's foolishness? Good! Jews demand miraculous signs and Greeks look for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified. A stumbling block to the Jews. Well, yeah, because the Jews thought that somebody that hung on a tree was cursed by God. And foolishness to the Gentiles. Well, yeah, because the person hanging on the cross is the one that lost the battle, not the one that won it. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. Brothers, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards, not many were influential, not many were of noble birth, but God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. What's the mystery of God? To use something as stupid and foolish as this, to establish a kingdom that no one even thinks is reigning. Why? Because we reign through the way in which we suffer for others. Well, that's stupid. That's foolish. That's the mystery of God. For in our foolishness, His wisdom is truly revealed. In our weakness, He is made strong. That's 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Lord, take this thorn away from me. No, my grace is sufficient for you. For when you are weak, then I am strong. So be weak. Well, that doesn't make any sense. How does that work? That's a bit mysterious and foolish all at the same time. And he says, no, it's Jesus. And the power of God in Jesus. Of course this is foolishness. Because the world refuses to accept the lenses that God's handing them. And until you put those on, you'll consistently think, this is the upside down kingdom. And the way that we fight in our kingdoms, and the way that we expand in our kingdoms, that's the way that makes the most sense. But what you'll realize when you're here is that's because the world's upside down. And all they do is keep shooting themselves in the foot. Over and 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 over.
But he says we'll be changed in the twinkling of...
Yeah, in 1 Corinthians 15 is about the resurrection. The mystery of Christ that through this we eventually lead to a resurrection in which we are redeemed. In which we are changed into what? Into those with the resurrected bodies. You know, this body that we're in right now is not what we'll have forever.
Thank God.
Yeah, exactly. Thank God. You know? Ultimately, we will have a resurrected body that does some weird things. Have you read John 21? Hello?
Are you telling me I'm going to be better looking than I am?
I can't promise you that, Joe. I think this just turned into a marriage counseling session. Huh? I don't know what's going on. Absolutely. Other questions? Yeah.
In the Bible, it talks about why hasn't God gone down to Hades and actually destroyed the evil in Earth completely? Why isn't He... Is God afraid of Satan?
Oh,
like,
no.
He hasn't gone down to Hades and destroyed Hades until Revelations. Why?
I talk some more. I'm trying to get a bearing.
Back at your, why does Satan even have power?
No.
Right?
Yeah. Like. Yeah. Why did? Mm-hmm.
Why did God even let Satan come in the beginning?
Like, I think, why hasn't? Mm-hmm. Why hasn't God come back to destroy Hades in the very first part? Why does he have to wait all the way? All these terrorist things happen, and let people know about it.
Mm-hmm.
Why hasn't he just gone to Hades and destroyed the devil?
Yeah, and there's an assumption in the question, and the assumption in the question is not something I'm accusing you of. It's just something that's natural. What we're saying is this: why didn't God do a better plan that I've thought of? Because His isn't very good. It's another way of saying the same thing. And my response back is who is God? Do I believe He is all-knowing and all-powerful and all-good? Do I believe that? And if so, then I'm not going to critique His plan as much as I'm going to live within it. It's very easy for me to sit back and say, you're wrong here and here and here and here and here. But from my finite perspective, that's a bold thing to say. It's to look at God and say, you didn't do this the right way. You should have done it better. And that's where I think God would look back and say, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? I'm not asking you to understand what's happening, God says. I'm asking you to be obedient within it. I'm not asking you to know it. Matter of fact, this is one of the things, this is a question about the bigness of God. Rick Atchley, there was a quote by him that said, we want a God that is so big He can do absolutely everything, but so small we can understand everything He does. That doesn't make any sense. Bottom line is this, I don't know why God does that. I don't know why God has Satan here. I don't know why God had or allowed Satan or whoever to have my wife and I have a miscarriage. I don't know. I don't know why pain ever happens. I don't know why the tornado happened. I don't know. But if I trust who He is, I don't need to know why. I need to know who. You hear my heart in that?
Yeah.
What I'm saying is this, let God be big. Let Him ask. Let Him answer the questions why. It's not your job. Your job is to submit to the who, not be obsessed with the why. Make sense?
Yeah.
Cool. I think we have time for probably one or two more questions. I think. Am I right? Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Yes?
From what I recall, I can't remember where it's at, but when Jesus died, He did go to hell.
Yeah, and
He got the keys of death.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so we can build on, first of all, I believe the initial question... It's more of a who, but let's talk about what the cross accomplished, because it did accomplish some stuff, you know. There is that weird passage. I believe it's in 1 Peter. Is that right? 1 Peter. Frankly, I don't know exactly what to do with it. Jesus going down and preaching to those that are imprisoned in Hades. What I do know is this. The cross does a couple of things. Not just one, we think it's just one, but it does a couple of things. And one of it is to destroy death for those that believe. And that is a major victory over Hades, I think. I think that's a huge, that was what we were talking about a minute ago, when it's like the key weapon of Satan now is no longer being able to be used, because every time you use it, it advances the church. And I look back at the person and I say, and you're telling me Satan's not bound?
Of course he is.
Absolutely he is. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I'm going, do you even know what the word bound means? It means restricted, constrained, not eradicated. Matter of fact, do you know that most of Paul's ministry was carried out when he was bound in chains? Just because you're bound doesn't mean you don't have a ministry. It means you're constrained or limited. And I think the cross accomplished that on some level. As a matter of fact, the word bound that's used in Revelation chapter 20 verses 1 through 3 is the same word that's used in Mark chapter 3 in the Beelzebub controversy, where Jesus says, I'm not doing this by the power of Satan. How could a kingdom divided advance? He says, as a matter of fact, it's kind of like this. He uses this parable, chapter 3 of Mark. He says, it's like you have a strong man, and if you want to rob him of his home, you have to first bind him. Same word. And he looks at him and he says, and that's what I'm doing. Every time I cast out a demon, you don't think that that restricts him some? When I die on the cross, you don't think that restricts him some? Whenever I empower a people with the Holy Spirit to rescue people through infirmities and sicknesses, if the people of God truly took serious carrying the least of these, you don't think that binds some of what makes Satan happy? He is set up for Satan to be destroyed. And he's saying, church, take it and run. The cross did that. We have made a major blow against the kingdom of Satan and Hades. Now we just need to participate in it by what we do. Yes?
Well, before his death, where did the Jewish people go?
Yeah, they're
would this not have been Christ going to Hades to talk to those people that had not had the opportunity to get receive his message?
Yeah, Hades has evolved. If I can say that. Etymologically, the word Hades in the Old Testament was a lot of times used to the abode of the dead. The dead. Indiscriminate, the dead. And this is actually what you see in the parable in Luke whenever Jesus is describing the rich man and Lazarus. And they both die and go to the abode of the dead, where in the great chasm that's between them, you have paradise on one side and you have the holding place of the evil on the other. And the whole thing in the Old Testament was described as Hades. I do believe, although I'll be honest with you, we're in the realm of speculation at this point. We have some passages that point towards some of this. But to say conclusively that all this is Loctite is to go beyond, I feel, what the Scripture clearly says. So know the territory I'm being backed into. Does that make sense? This was all called Hades. However, the way in which this word is used in Revelation, it no longer includes the good. It does have an evolution where the word Hades eventually means the abode of the evil dead. I do know that shift happens. And whenever I'm using the word etymologically, I'm using it to mean the development of the way in which the word is used. That's all. It's just a $25 word that doesn't really mean anything. But it does mean something. All at the same time. So the etymological development of the word was that it does at one point describe the whole abode of the dead, both evil and good. But it does eventually get to the point where the way it's used in Revelation especially is the abode of the evil dead. What happened in between? A big fat cross. That's the only explanation that I have for the shift in way in which this word used is that Jesus does something where now, it's not all one abode. For this side, paradise is in the presence of Jesus. To depart from the body is to be in the presence of the Lord.
In Ephesians 4, kind of cover what happened after, but if Jesus went down and led captives, a train of captives, would that be where he was taking the residents of paradise? Yeah. The souls of those in paradise.
Ephesians 4. Let's read it aloud. I'm a context guy. Verse 4, let's start in verse 1. As a prisoner for the Lord, then I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you have received. Ooh, I love that. As a prisoner of the Lord, as a doulos of the Lord, I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you've received. Be completely humble and gentle. Be patient, bearing with one another in love. Make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called to one hope when you were called. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. But to each one of us, grace has been given as Christ apportioned it. This is why it says, when he ascended on high, he led captives in his train and gave gifts to men. Maybe. What does he ascended mean, except that he also descended to the lower earthly regions? Ooh. I don't know if I could. That sounds more like incarnation than it does the ransacking of Hades. He who descended is the very one who ascended higher than all the heavens in order to fill the whole universe. I don't know. For me,
the verse they use to.
No, they'd be talking about. It's in 1 Peter where he talks about going down and preaching to those that are imprisoned in Hades. That's the passage that is a weird one. It's an aberration. We don't know exactly what to do with it. If I'm being flat out honest.
It describes
what is it
about
this one
to hell and death.
Yeah, and that's in Revelation 1:19-20. Yeah, that he does have the keys over death and Hades, which means he has the authority. And how does that happen? Through the cross and the resurrection. I know that much. So you hear what I'm doing. I'm telling you what I know and what I can say. But I'm tentative about saying what is beyond that, because ultimately that's the realm of nonsense. It's in the realm of what I can't actually accomplish. Are you following me? Yes.
Stupid question.
Probably not, but go ahead.
As far as Revelation is concerned, mm-hmm. Where do you think we stand right now? What part of it are we in?
Oh,
The last days.
Yeah, that's a difficult question. Well.
We should be busy doing God's work.
Yes, this is how to answer the question. Martin Luther was asked the question, if you knew Jesus was coming back tomorrow, what would you do? He said, I plant my garden today. I think that question for Revelation is the wrong question. Because I think consistently the New Testament teaches that the where question is impossible for us to answer because Jesus comes like a thief, period. Right. He always comes like a thief. There is no roadmap. There are no... Check this out. I believe... This one, we'll end on this.
We're in the end.
I believe that there is absolutely nothing that needs to happen before Jesus can come back. I don't believe that we're waiting for a rapture. I don't believe we're waiting for an antichrist. I don't believe that we're waiting for anything except for Jesus to come back and take us home. I believe that it could happen before I finish this sentence. One day that's going to happen. I'm telling you. One day that's going to happen. And that's what I believe the Bible is pretty consistently on. Is that the where question is one that we are obsessed with. And that's the one that I feel like the Bible consistently rebukes us over. About dates and times, 1 Thessalonians 5 verse 1. I don't need to write to you because you know the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. Matthew 24:36. No one knows the time, not the Father, or not the angels or the Son, but only the Father. Revelation 16:15. Behold, I come like a thief. The imagery of thief and suddenness. Matter of fact, in 1 Thessalonians 5, when you keep going, it says, while they're screaming, peace and security, which is something Rome would have been screaming, suddenly destruction will befall them. It's very sudden. It's always sudden. We're not going to be able to say, oh, there we are. It'll never happen. It's not possible. And that's why consistently, what people that do that, like Harold Camping and Edgar Weisenot, they destroy people's faith. Right now, I heard it's actually somewhat sad and it breaks my heart. But this is the fruit of that ministry of predicting. Harold Camping's church was a couple of thousand when it was back in May. And what I heard after this past October, it's down to about 6. And most of those people probably didn't go to the next church or the next predictor. A lot of those people probably abandoned the faith. Because I actually have a website in my notes. And it's a non-Christian that lists all of the predictions that Christians have gotten wrong about the second coming. And the implication is this, if they get the second coming wrong, they probably got the first one wrong too. We need to be rebuked.
Well, according to the Mayans, it's 1 year, 1 month, and 10 days.
Yeah, it was funny. When I was in Guatemala, they took us on a tour, and this guy happened to be an expert in the Mayan calendar, and he said, actually, a couple of things. Number one, the Mayan calendar recapitulates. It's never ending, number one. He said, number two, where that calendar date actually ends was 50 years ago. So, but you know what I did notice?
Well, my theory is that all the people that knew how to compute that calendar died.
Well, the Mayans aren't around, that's for sure. What I did notice, though, is that Edgar Weisenot predicts it in 1988. Then we have the year 2000, when it almost happens again, and now 2012. So I've got dibs on 2024. Because apparently it's just every 12 years we just come up with a prediction and make a lot of money. So I'm copywriting it now, and we'll see what happens.
About 10 or 15 years ago, they said Jesus went down Highway 70 in a minivan.
But they probably saw me in the rearview mirror. It happens all the time. It's a weird occurrence. When I'm like, no, I try to look like him every day, but it has nothing to do with my hair or my beard. Anyway. Yes, last question.
Like the bad things happening, like the tornado in Joplin. I think it teaches us something, or it should teach us something. And that's where to put our values.
Absolutely.
It's not like in our china and our crystal and our thing.
You're exactly right.
But to put it in our heart.
Yeah. And yeah, you know, I love that you brought that up, because it is amazing when you talk to people that are in the midst of intense suffering. A lot of times what they ask you to pray. I was traveling through to Russia to Goose and to Kostroma with Vivert Law. And I was lecturing on Revelation. He was lecturing on suffering and persecution as Christians in India. And he asked them always to pray for them. So I asked him, I said, what do you want us to pray for you in particular? I said, obviously you want us to pray that, you know, the persecution stop and stuff. And he goes, oh, I never really even thought of that. I said, what? What do you mean you didn't think of that? He goes, actually, what I always ask people to pray for is just that we have stronger backs to endure. And it was pretty interesting because he uses the same language that I read in this book called Back to Jerusalem about the underground church in China. And one of the underground church in China ministers said, pray that we have stronger backs to endure, but not that the persecution is to stop. He said, because the more they persecute us, the more the church grows. Yeah, the more the church grows. And
I know how important it is to go on the foreign mission field, but I personally feel that if we don't do our missions at home, we don't have the people to go into the foreign mission.
Yeah, and here's the thing about the callings with God. Everyone's got a calling. Everyone's got a calling. You know, that there's a part of me, my heart, obviously, I don't know if, hopefully you hear my heart for overseas is huge. But I don't believe that the Lord has given me the privilege to call me to anywhere but where I'm at. And therefore, I will not lament that I'm not overseas. But where I'm at, I will make that my overseas, and I'll do whatever I can to bring people to Jesus here. And that's what I pray for you guys. For this church, for all of you in here, that's what I hope and I pray for you too. Thanks for having me this weekend. Love you guys. Appreciate you having me in, and take care of my brother. I'd appreciate it. All right. Have a good night.